Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights with me, your host, Katie Kiefer. And today we're talking about Hormel. It's one of my favorite topics, of course, is pork production. Well, meat production in general. And we're going to be talking today with Ted Genoways, who has just published a, shall we say, somewhat incendiary. I don't think I exaggerate there. Somewhat incendiary book called The Chain. Ted is, let me just get to my notes here. Whoops. Here we go. Ted is the editor-at-large for On Earth. He's been on this show before. In fact, he was here in March, the magazine of the Natural Resources Defense Council. He has also contributed to a number of other magazines, such as The Atlantic, Bloomberg, Business Week, Harper's, Mother Jones, The New Republic, and Outside. His new book, The Chain Factory, The Chain Farm, Factory, and the Fate of Our Food was published just this month by HarperCollins, and he is everywhere and on every radio show. So I'm really grateful for him for taking the time with me today. Ted, welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's been quite a whirlwind experience for you, my friend, in these last few weeks. I just see your name popping up all over the place, whether it's print, whether it's radio. Have you done TV yet?
No TV yet, but you know, I'm available if anyone wants to book me.
Yeah, I'll let all my friends know it, like Rachel Maddow. I don't know why Rachel, actually, just as a brief aside, I don't know why at least MSNBC, some of the hosts don't ever pick up on any of these food stories. Because I think these are tremendous, especially your book, being so much about labor relations. I think these are hugely important stories for Americans to understand, not only about their food, but for me, this was an education in immigration law and why we really need to pass some reforms. So let us jump right into the discussion about labor, since that's primarily what you cover in the book. I mean, obviously there's other material there because it's Hormel and it's pig packing and it's, you know, all kinds of stuff like that, antitrust. There's a lot of material there. Can you give us a little history of the labor relations with Hormel from its beginning? Because it was a family-owned company in the initial phases, and it did have some very, very fair union contracts when it started. And then that sort of unraveled, and I kind of want to have you take us from there.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that's exactly right. The company, there was a strike in 1933 during the Depression that was a big strike. But Jay Hormel, who was the son of the founder of the company, recognized that organized labor was coming, and that the best thing to do was to forge a kind of shared set of goals with the workforce, mm-hmm. and so he established a salary system, which was unheard of at the time, to pay somebody a 12-month salary for what had been sort of seasonal labor, but also established, a pension system that there would be warning if there was going to be layoffs, that they would have 12 months advance notice, all sorts of progressive moves. And what this did was create a really unparalleled period of labor and management harmony. That started to unravel in the 1970s when the company passed out of the hands of the Hormel family, and the people who had trained as managers under Jay Hormel started to retire and were replaced by a new, much more corporate set of leaders. And in particular, Dick Knowlton, who was himself the son of a meat packer who had worked at the scales at the Austin plant in Minnesota, but had trained as a manager, he was obsessed with the idea of automating and mechanizing as much of the process as possible, mm-hmm. and believed that if you could replace a worker with a machine, then you not only had less trouble with worker relations, but you also had a system that was less and less skilled so that you could pay lower wages and offer fewer benefits to unskilled workers.
Amazing. Okay, so we get to the 70s, the whole sort of face of meatpacking, because I imagine that they were not alone, that Hormel was not alone in adopting, A, the more mechanized processes that we see today, and B, using less skilled workers. I mean, I thought it was fascinating that in the 30s, there was actually some sense of responsibility of corporation towards worker and vice versa, and that even as early as the 70s, and I don't think most of us think necessarily is that was the era of union busting, but it clearly was. So what happened after that? Like, what was the next? How did the union busting, because there was a huge strike in the 70s, right, or the early 80s?
What happened was that Dick Knowlton convinced the management at Hormel, convinced the board that what they needed was an entirely new plant. Mm-hmm. That where they could implement all of the automated processes that he had been developing when he was in charge of that division. And he sold it to management by saying, we'll be able to slash wages. He sold the same plan to the union by saying, it will reduce the amount of work that you have to do to process each animal as it comes through, which was true. But what he left out was that the real plan was to run far more animals through the plant than they ever had before in each shift.
And that's what we call increasing the chain speed.
Absolutely. And so the plant is set, everything runs on a chain conveyor system. Mm-hmm. And that conveyor carries a certain number of animals per hour through the processing line. And the speed of the chain is negotiated between management and the union, and it is managed down to a single animal. Both sides have systems engineers who actually walk the floor counting cogs in the chain, uh-huh. and with a stopwatch to make sure that the chain is running at the speed that everybody has agreed on.
Wow!
And so it's very managed and very timed. But the union in this case had gotten, in my estimation, a little bit trusting of management and thought, well, if they're saying that this is going to be better, we'll go along and agree with that. And unfortunately for them, they also signed a no-strike agreement saying until the plant has had a chance to get up and running and recoup some of the expense that was incurred in building the plant, we promise not to go on strike. So the workers showed up. They found that the processes were not easier. They were, in fact, more repetitive, and there was a rash of carpal tunnel syndrome and tennis elbow and other repetitive stress injuries. They found that the knives that they were working with now which were mechanical knives, were harder to deal with and harder to sharpen, and uh-huh. that caused more stress and injury. And they couldn't go on strike.
right.
And on top of all of that, the company said, we are going to ask you to take about a 27% pay cut. So
because?
Predictably, because they said the rest of the industry is going this way. The cost of labor is going down. And if you don't want to take this pay cut, we can find somebody that we can train to do the kind of repetitive cuts that you are doing now. This is no longer a skilled job.
Right. So you're not a butcher anymore. You're just a guy who makes one cut in one direction on one muscle,
right.
and then it moves on to the next worker, and they finish that cut. Anybody who's been to a meatpacking facility knows what that's what it looks like. It's a really, repetition is barely does justice to
the
mind-numbing quality of this work. But anyway, I want to just move on a little bit, because fascinating as that is, in 2008, you say, is the beginning of city legislation efforts aimed against the undocumented workers that the unions began to bring in because people did quit the jobs because of the 27% pay cut, right? And so they brought in a lot more undocumented workers, and suddenly that became a whole racial and labor dispute within these small towns in Minnesota. And so I wanted to ask you, like, I was curious that instead of blaming the company Hormel or QPP, the spinoff that became the packing company, why did people turn against the townspeople turn so much against the undocumented or the workers who were right from outside, rather than saying to the company, well, you just screwed us out of, middle class jobs? I mean, people had before been able to support a family, go on vacation, build a retirement fund. And then when the wages fell so drastically and only, illegal workers would come in and take them, nobody got mad at the company. They just got pissed off at the workers. And I thought that was a really curious phenomenon. I wondered if you had some insight on that wanted to bring out.
I think I do. I mean, the thing that I think one has to remember is that after the strike in 85 and 86, mm-hmm. the part of the way that the strike was resolved was that Hormel promised to hire back with preferential status union workers who had lost their jobs while they were on strike. So they were told that they would be hired back to the company. But instead, Hormel said, we're going to take half the operation, the cut-and-kill side of the operation. We're going to say now that that's a new company called Quality Pork Processors.
Right.
It's within the four walls of the plant that we just built.
Yeah.
At the time, it shared a parking lot and an entrance. It was, as one guy at the union told me, it's like taking a room in your house and saying, that's no longer part of my house, and I'm not responsible for anything that happens in there.
And as a result, they could also bust that union contract, right?
That's right. So they said, in that room, there's no union contract.
Amazing.
And so the people who work in this part of the plant get a lower pay wage, they don't have the same benefits, and they don't have a union contract with us. So we don't have to hire back the union workers into this part of the operation anymore.
Right.
And for a lot of the people who had grown up with the union in Austin, they regarded this new workforce as a scab labor force. They were union busters.
Yeah.
And they responded in the kind of traditional way of anger, yes, at the company, but also trying to drive out the union busters in order to keep the union strong. But the reality was that by that point, the union was so wounded that there was no possibility of going out on strike. There was no possibility of raising hell with the company, and they just had to accept that this was the new reality.
Wow. This is one for the history books. It really is. It's
yeah.
an extraordinary story that you tell, and I wish we could do more justice to it in this conversation. But we're going to move right along, because
sure.
one of the things that you bring up more towards the end of the book, but is a very interesting alliance between the company Hormel and the ACLU, who were trying to sort of mitigate some of the economic impact of driving that new workforce, that scab labor, out of town. So I wondered if you could just expand on that a little bit, because I thought that
sure.
was fascinating. The ACLU is involved.
I know. Yeah. It ends.
What?
The situation ends up crazy. And so this was in Fremont, Nebraska.
Right.
Fremont had a similar situation to what occurred in Austin, except they said, we will accept a two-tier wage scale within the plant if you just keep it all as Hormel and all the people are allowed to remain in the union.
Mm-hmm.
But what that did was essentially cut union wages deeply for everyone in the town.
Right.
So you've got a festering dislike for the new workforce that has come in, this immigrant workforce that's come in. And when the recession starts to take hold and you've hit hard times in 06 and 07, and then there's this kind of growing nativist movement as embodied by the laws in Arizona and Alabama and some of the other ordinances that were popping up against immigration, all of which were authored by the same guy, Chris Kobach.
Right. And this is the show your documents law, just to be clear.
That's exactly right. You get people within the town of Fremont who start saying, this is what we need to have happen here. We need an ordinance that makes it so that they can't get jobs in town, so that they can't rent a house in town. The original version of the ordinance was that there couldn't be any sort of harboring, whatever exactly that means, of undocumented immigrants.
Wow.
And so the ACLU rides in and says this is all unconstitutional, and they're right that it is, but the funding that they end up getting, much of it for the campaign in town, comes from Hormel, because Hormel does not want this ordinance either.
Right.
But they can't publicly say that they don't want the ordinance, because the obvious question would be, why does Hormel oppose an ordinance that would make it so that you couldn't hire undocumented workers? Well, the reason is that they have a largely undocumented workforce.
Right.
So there was this transaction that occurred where Hormel provided money, and the ACLU and some other liberal groups used that money to publicly run the campaign against the ordinance. But it was all to no avail. The ordinance, when it came to a vote, passed overwhelmingly, and when the city was given the opportunity to backtrack and had a second vote on it, it passed by an even wider margin.
And Ted, why was it that the ACLU, or I mean, this is speculation, but it just, don't you find it curious that the ACLU did not sort of probe more deeply into the ulterior motives of Hormel and see the union busting as something that that also merited investigation and potentially, you know, legislation, or at least some sort of legal inquiry? Why didn't they? I mean, what was the deal? Like, how come they got to whitewash that?
Yeah, I think it was an uncomfortable arrangement for probably everybody involved. I don't have the sense that the ACLU was any too happy to be dealing with Hormel, and probably Hormel was not thrilled to be giving money to the ACLU.
Although it's a great public relations move for them, I mean, on the surface of it, right?
Except that they didn't publicize it at all. They didn't want anybody to know that they were opposing the ordinance. And even when the transaction became public and I questioned them about this, they simply said that they thought that it was best for the people who were, you know, the Chamber of Commerce and the people who were in the city council to take the lead in voicing opposition to the ordinance.
Yeah, that makes sense, I guess.
Well, I mean, it makes sense from a public relations standpoint.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally. I mean, it's true. You wouldn't want the town in which your, you know, plant is located to know that you're actually the one who's looking to force these undocumented workers into your workforce.
And it's absurd, of course, because people, on the one hand, everybody in town knows that this is where the workforce has come from, where the people have come from.
Yeah.
But at the same time, talk about shooting yourself in the foot. I mean, the town seems not to acknowledge that Hormel actually sits just across the city limits, so it is not affected by this ordinance. Most of the people who work in the plant who do not have documented status live in a trailer park that is outside the city limits.
Right.
And so the ordinance, the only thing that it really accomplishes is scaring away businesses who look at this as something that gives the town a black eye and would be bad for their business to be associated with.
Wow. Yeah, that is. And also, of course, I mean, the other thing that you mentioned in the book, and this makes sense, is like those undocumented workers, they rent properties. I mean, you know, so there's an economic impact on the town, you know, when you start saying, well, you can't, I don't know, you can't rent, you can't get a license, you can't, whatever it is, whatever the ordinance called for. But it was, I thought it was really interesting. Talk about shooting yourself in the foot. I want to like rush along here because I want to talk about HIMP. HIMP is the HACCP Inspection Models Project. I've done a few programs about this, actually quite a few programs about it. And what it means is, and it's particularly prevalent now in the poultry industry, but it was pioneered essentially in the pork pork processing industry. And it means hemp is sort of HACCP, is hazardous analysis and critical control points. That's what we use to keep our food chain safe. You know, there are all these different spots on the chain line, on the production line, where theoretically a USDA inspector is looking and evaluating whether or not the animal has, you know, obvious tumors or blemishes, right, or bruises, broken bones, blah, blah, blah. So then the pork industry, I think, was the pioneer for hemp.
Yeah.
And it was all about increasing the chain speed and reducing inspection, because they claimed that they would be able to inspect far better, and that it was all about the microbial swabs that the USDA inspectors would get at the end of the chain line. And so, right, even though the Government Accountability Office, and I actually had one of the, you know, one of the top guys from GAO come on the show and explain why they were objecting to hemp last year, it still got passed. So how did that happen? How did we get this, even though it's been protested widely throughout, you know, the food production, including USDA inspectors, you know, writing, right, letters to Congress and everything? So what happened with that?
So I think part of this is that the way that, that hemp is described and the way that HACCP systems are described makes intuitive sense. There's the statement that what we're going to do is testing for at a microbial level for pathogens that are that exist on the meat.
Right.
And that seems to make a lot of sense. You say, well, this is scientific, this is more advanced than the old method, which is manual inspection, which, yeah, the industry ridiculed as poke and sniff, that,
yeah,
because you feel for tumors, you feel for granules that would indicate illness in the intestines, and you smell things to see if there's, you know, if there's anything rotting, which is obviously,
right,
a sign of illness. But the idea was that this will be more advanced. The thing is that what you are getting is not a one-to-one comparison of manual inspection against a microbial inspection. What you're getting is, in current plants, that you would have 7 meat inspectors on the line in a pork plant. And on a hemp plant, you have 4 inspectors instead.
Right.
And only one of them is actually working on the line. The others are double-checking paperwork and doing double-checks of work that is done by the quality assurance people who have been hired by the company.
Uh-huh.
And what this does for the company is allow them to only have one inspector on the line who potentially slows things down or stops production because of a problem, and it allows the line to run much, much faster. And the whole notion of this, and especially this has been true in poultry, is that this is okay to do because the consumers will cook and kill anything that is on the meat that is harmful.
Right.
And not only now have they said, well, this is okay for this reduced inspection, but they've, you know, there's a push now, as I'm sure you know, to have Campylobacter and to have Salmonella removed from the list of adulterants.
They've never actually acquired the status of true adulterants like E. coli,
right,
has. So they're still just, you know, they're just like, you know, cost of doing business. I mean,
exactly.
There's a big push to make them adulterants. That's
right.
For sure.
So, but to have them not listed as adulterants is to say that it is perfectly fine for,
right,
for a chicken breast to go into commerce covered with Salmonella.
Yeah.
And the argument is that you know, you're going to cook that chicken breast and it's going to be fine.
Right.
But what it ignores, and you know, circling back to where we started, is what the exposure to these bacteria means for the people who handle that meat all the way through the process.
Ah.
And there's no concern for what's going on inside the plant with the plant workers who are exposed to all of these drug-resistant bacteria.
Right.
And to me, that should be at least as much of a concern as the consumer safety is.
Yeah, very interesting. I mean, it has been proven over and over again that people who work in pork processing facilities or even in a pork farm or CAFO,
right,
will have a very high incidence of MRSA
that's
in,
right,
their systems, even if they're not symptomatic, and that's methicillin resistant Staph aureus, right?
Yes.
Unfortunately, we have to take a quick break here, but we will be right back with Ted Genoways to continue this fascinating discussion about pork processing and Hormel. So stay tuned. This is What Doesn't Kill You.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. A full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And we are back. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. I'm talking today with Ted Genoways, who has a new book out on the shelves, and he is everywhere and definitely should be paid attention to. His book is called The Chain, Farm, Factory, and the Fate of Our Food. It came out this month from HarperCollins. I urge you to take a look at it and learn more about immigration law, about undocumented workers, about union busting, the history of labor in this country. It's just, and of course, all about the pork packing industry. It's a great book, I got to say. And I'm sure you've had more than your share of comparisons between this and Chris Leonard's great book, The Meat Racket, came out last year, or last spring, I should say. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But I want to just quickly address one of my favorite stories in the meat packing industry. This caught my eye as yours, but I wasn't smart enough to write a book about it. And that was the whole fascinating story of how liquefied pork brains rendered a whole slew of workers incredibly sick with a mysterious neurological disorder that has never gone away for most of them. So can you can you take us through a little, just a quick history of that? Because definitely it hit the news and then it left the news and then nobody ever said another word. And so you go into great detail, actually, about what happened to those workers and what the fallout from that issue was and how it connects to the idea of chain speed. So let's wrap that up.
Sure. Yeah. So this occurred at a part of the quality pork processing plant in Austin, Minnesota, that is known as the head table. And it is exactly what it sounds like. It's the place where the pork heads are processed. And as the heads pass down the line, there's somebody there who, you know, cuts off the ears, who clips the snouts, scrape the meat from the palates, take the cheek meat off. The very last place on the last station at the end of the head table, there was a plexiglass shield. The denuded skull would slide through an opening there, and a worker on the other side would take the skull and insert a brass nozzle into the opening at the back of the skull, which would trip a trigger and release a blast of pressurized air. And the air was enough to liquefy the brains, which then were poured into a catch bucket.
Yummy.
And the skull was dropped down a chute to go for being ground up into bone meal.
Now, because brains are, just to stop you here, but brains and spinal cord tissue, these are all considered in the pork. I know they are in the cattle industry, but in the pork industry, they're also considered basically biohazards.
At this point, the pork brains were considered product.
Really?
The pork brains were being collected and were being sold to Korea for thickener and stir fry. So this was they were harvesting this to put it into 20-bound containers that they would ship and
right.
sell. But the problem was that the blast of air that was going in was just enough that it was not just liquefying the brains, but also aerosolizing a small amount of brain tissue.
Yeah.
So you had this fine mist that was in the air that was brain matter.
Uh-huh.
And it was affecting first the people who worked at the brain machine, but eventually other people on the head table and people who were in proximity to the head table, supervisors who passed through the area. And what was going on is that they were inhaling the brain tissue. Their bodies were reacting to this and creating antibodies to kill the foreign cells. But because pig cells are similar enough in structure, especially neural cells, to human cells,
right.
that the antibodies didn't stop with the pig cells. They moved on to attacking the nerve cells, the spinal cells, the brain cells in the meatpacking workers themselves.
Right.
And the thing is that this was a practice that they had engaged in for a number of years. They had started back in the early 90s collecting these brains.
Uh-huh.
But what happened was that between 2002 and 2007, the speed of the line, the chain went from moving at 900 animals per hour to 1,350 animals per hour.
Wow.
And this is a direct result of the hemp program. This is this is having reduced inspection and being allowed to run the line faster. You see an increase of 50% in just a few years.
Yeah.
And now it's not a small amount of brain tissue in the air. It's a growing amount, and eventually it was large enough that there were more than two dozen people who had inhaled the brain matter and had this autoimmune response.
Unbelievable.
And as you said, some of them, the most severe cases, have ended up with permanent spine and brain damage.
That's just an astonishing story. And of course, the company, well, I think people can guess what happened, which was that, after paying lip service to support, essentially many of them were screwed. Am I right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, many of the people who were affected were undocumented workers.
Right.
There were a number of them whose immigration status was questioned. They were either fired or scared into leaving and lost contact with the social worker who managed their workers' comp claim. The few people who have gotten any sort of compensation out of the company, most of them settled for 6 months' pay.
Yeah, I mean, it was astonishing to me. Permanent disability equals a $12,000 payout. Thank you.
Right.
Goodbye. You're ruined.
Yeah.
One thing that struck me, and this is just pure speculation on my part, and actually you just helped me a lot in your explanation of reminding me that pork cells are very similar to human cells, which is why we use them so much in scientific experimentation. But I also was curious about some of the drugs that we routinely feed our particularly pork in the form of like beta agonists, in the form of course, the ubiquitous antibiotics used to manage disease. And some of the other drugs and growth hormones that are typically used in livestock agriculture. Do you think that any of those may have contributed to the severity of the symptoms, or is that just pure speculation on my part?
I don't know that it contributed to the symptoms in this case, but I do think it's important to, as you said, to acknowledge that the studies indicate that hog barn workers have test positive for MRSA at a rate of about 45%, which is just off the charts for a human population.
Right.
And what that indicates is that what is going into the hogs is winding up in the waste and in the air and water around
right.
those confinements. And it's almost certainly winding up in the loading areas at the plants. And if you've ever talked to anybody about how these plants work, there's no outside access from Hormel, but almost all of the knives are run on a pneumatic system. Mm. So there's pressurized air that's everywhere, and there's just swirling winds every place. So any
place, tons of fans, too. Yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. exactly. And so anything that is attached or contained in hog waste is going to be in the air and being breathed in. And if you can get MRSA from those conditions, I don't see why you wouldn't be getting exposure to anything else that's being fed to the hogs
sure.
as well.
Yeah. Okay, good point. So let's move on because I want to we only have about I'm going to say 11 minutes.
Okay.
So, and as you know from my outline, I have a lot more questions. One of the things that you touch on, and I kind of wish you had more sort of scope to expand on this, is something that Chris Leonard worked on a lot in his book, The Meat Racket. And that is the whole idea of vertical integration and
right.
sort of, even though I love white oak pastures and they are vertically integrated, it's of a whole different subset when you're talking about somebody like Hormel, who then spins off a QPP, but essentially it's still an all integrated system right down to the growers. And I just wanted to right. talk a little bit about how that consolidation in both pork and poultry is affecting the industries and affecting workers and sort of the quality of the animals and all of that stuff. There are
sure.
a lot of parallels to draw there, and I wish you would do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's a similar thing that and I trace this back to hemp, that when you get these mm. increased line speeds, which they're allowed to run and fully implement in 2004, I don't think it's coincidence that by 2005, the producers that are centered in the Midwest are pressing to have the vertical integration bans removed in the
yeah.
Midwest. And Hormel, in particular, benefits because you figure that their main cut-and-kill operations are in southern Minnesota and in eastern Nebraska.
Yeah.
And so when they get a special exemption in Iowa, which is right in between, that allows them to have a stronger involvement in the construction of hog confinements, to own the hogs that are in the barns, to own cropland that raises feed to feed the hogs.
Right.
That now what they have is a great deal more control over their supply chain.
Yeah.
And not only does this allow the kind of price fixing that Chris Leonard's book deals with extensively and extremely well and allow the market manipulation that he's focused on, but what it also means is that the supply is can be standardized. And this is really the thing that Hormel was pushing for. If you're going to automate your plant, then what you want is a standard sized hog coming
That's right.
through the door.
Every piece exactly the same size.
Exactly.
And shape.
You want to have 19,000 hogs that arrive in Austin, Minnesota each day that weigh the exact same amount on the hoof, that have the same lean to fat ratio,
mm-hmm.
that have the same sized. All the cuts are the same size.
Confirmation is exactly the same. So every pork chop, no matter which animal it comes from, number one or number 19,000, is exactly the same.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so and what that means is that you've got a kind of industrial attitude toward all of this raising. And to me, it's not farming anymore at that point.
Definitely.
You're not raising individual animals. What you're doing is feeding a diet to an animal that will within a set period of time grow to be a certain size and proportion that you can deliver to the next stage in the industrialized process, and it turns the hogs from animals into widgets, in my opinion.
Oh yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, and we've seen just as an aside in the poultry industry, we've seen what that genetic engineering or genetic manipulation to
right.
achieve that standardization has done to chickens and turkeys. Turkeys are now engineered to grow to market weight. They can be 50 pounds. I learned recently, and
right.
we'll be talking about that in a future show. But they can get turkeys up to 50 pounds in about 6 months, and the animal literally cannot move. It
That's
is just
right.
fall forwards on its breast. And that, to a certain extent, hogs experience some serious difficulties with this regimen that they're on, including the beta agonists that will do things like make their hooves fall off or, you know, cause all kinds of mobility issues. But we digress. Let us, because this is another really important thing, because this just happened. I was doing my research yesterday. When I talked to you last March, it was about an excerpt from the book about water quality issues and local drinking water. And this is increasingly a major agricultural issue across the United States. Really, no matter which part of ag you work in, water quality is becoming more and more of a major problem, thanks to all of the stuff that we pump in. And one of the things that happens when you vertically integrate your system, as Hormel has done, is that they take the manure from those CAFOs and they spray it all over their feed crops, which they then feed to the animals. But the runoff goes into the water system. So you have a fantastic couple of chapters about that. And you bring up the fact that there's some legislation pending. Well, in September, and I'm sure you saw this, the U.S. House, that's our Republican House, today voted to approve legislation that would prevent the development and implementation of a regulation expanding the scope of the Federal Clean Water Act to cover most of the country's water bodies, ditches, and gullies, a rule which, quote unquote, would be particularly detrimental to agriculture. So let's talk about that for a second, because that's a serious problem. I mean, if the Senate follows suit and this law and this legislation becomes passed as law, then that means that anyone who's involved in agriculture can basically, you know, blow any crap they want to into the water supply with no repercussions. So talk a little bit about the guys that you had a great chapter about the guy who's like tried to stop the plant on one side and then it ends up popping up on the other side. And
Yeah, well, and that's, so, I mean, especially in north central Iowa, there's been a huge boom in the building of these CAFOs and doing exactly what you're saying, which is spreading the manure often in the section exactly where the CAFO is situated. And that it's a part of the state that is extremely hilly that also is, there's almost nothing in the way of trees or other vegetation to prevent erosion. And it happens to also be, you know, where you get the headwaters for both the Des Moines and the Raccoon River watersheds, which happen to be where most of the state gets its drinking water.
Incredible.
And so when you get a lot of manure that's applied and is getting into these small waterways in the northern part of the state at the top of the watershed, it's all going to flow downhill and into the larger creeks and the rivers and make its way eventually across the state. And what the folks at the Des Moines Water Works were telling me is that they can see after a rain, they have monitoring stations that go from Des Moines all the way up to the northern part of the state. When it rains, they can see the nitrate levels and the E. coli levels jump. They know exactly what's going on. That is the manure running off into the river. And they, in particular, have been having a challenge with trying to keep the nitrate levels down, because what is coming in at their intakes, which is near the confluence of the Des Moines and the Raccoon Rivers, is often two and three times the levels that are allowable under the Clean Water Act. And they've got to do what they can to process and bring that down to the safe drinking levels. And that's great for the people of Des Moines and the people who are on the Des Moines Waterworks drinking system. But for everybody who is upstream in smaller municipalities where they don't have the same resources, or especially the people who are on well systems, what that means is that the water that they're drinking is almost certainly higher in nitrates than is allowable by the Clean Water Act. And there, I don't see why anyone engaged in agriculture would say to themselves, I don't care if there's poison in my wells. I don't want the EPA coming in and measuring.
Right.
I I don't understand that resistance.
Well, you describe it very well, because you say, the farmers are saying, well, I'm growing the food and we can't live without the food that we're eating. You know, you can't live without me. And then on the other side, the waterworks are saying, but you can't live without water, homie. I mean, yeah. It's incredible to me that that the agriculture, especially large scale agriculture, is so profoundly resistant to any kind of dialogue, much less change. That involves altering their practices. And I just want to, we really have to close now, but I just want to get your take on that. What is it going to take? What will have to happen in terms of legislation, in terms of community involvement, in terms of, whatever, to get sort of the environmental side of things in line with agriculture in a way where everyone can thrive? What's your magic bullet?
Yeah, I think that unfortunately this is not one of those problems that gets solved at the grocery store. People often want to say, well, what do I boycott? What do I stop buying? But when you're talking even about a company like Hormel, you have to remember that Hormel is not just the pork products that they sell. This is also Jennie-O turkeys and Jiffy peanut butter, Skippy peanut butter. Yeah. And Holy Guacamole and Chi-Chi's Salsa. I mean, they are a giant, diversified company, and it's not going to be possible to simply boycott them into doing something different in the way that they run their business. It requires government involvement and government oversight.
Yeah.
And what we need to do is demand that our congressional leaders take on these problems, and also pressure the president. The USDA answers to Obama, and I am still really surprised that the industry has been allowed to run amok as much as it has in recent years.
Yeah, me too.
And only to the benefit of the Republican interests in the Midwestern states. I don't understand why somebody like Obama is not stepping in and saying, this isn't in my best interest politically, and it's not in the best interest of people who are living in these states, and to try to make a little bit of a difference in the environmental quality and in the quality of life.
Yeah, I find it fascinating. I mean, I'm sure you saw the executive order that he signed recently about antibiotics, how we need better stewardship. And yet any regulation or any sense of really pulling the teeth of agriculture in terms of antibiotic overuse just didn't make it into the final draft of that executive order. It was a very, very, really quite surprising to me and shocking. And I don't understand why he's not paying more attention to this. But unfortunately, we must wrap it up. I hate to say goodbye, Ted.
Thanks very much for having me.
This has been great.
I really appreciate
it. So you have a website. Tell us what the website is. We must promote. Do you have any events coming up in New York?
You can find me at tedgenoways.com. Mm-hmm. That makes it as easy as can be. And then, of course, the book is available in bookstores and online booksellers everywhere.
Absolutely. And, keep listening, because you're going to be, I'm hoping you're going to be everywhere and all over the place. But there's definitely been a lot of coverage. Mother Jones has covered you, a bunch of other publications. I wish you the best of luck with this. And I hope it's you and Chris Leonard are sort of the bellwethers leading this movement to really address, open up the eyes of the United States to what is actually going on in terms of labor, in terms of immigration, and why it's so important that we pay attention to those aspects and not just whether or not there's animal cruelty going on in somebody's slaughterhouse.
Right.
You know what I mean? These are bigger issues, and these are the ones that are really going to have an impact on our nation going forward. So thank you so much for your work, and thank you so much for being on the show. Really appreciate it. And thanks to the wonderful White Oak Pastures for their sponsorship. We'll see you next week. Thanks for listening, folks. Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.